Someone else. The father, maybe? Mark asked.
I don't think so. I eyed him coldly, throwing the covers off, and I felt my heart going hard toward him. It wasn't his fault that he didn't understand that nothing was ever simple with Lottie, yet still I held it against him. As I got out of bed, Mark looked at my mother's long white nightgown with puzzlement.
What are you wearing?
I just shook my head as Anna and Autumn came running into the bedroom, their hair sticking up at odd angles from sleeping on it wet.
Daddy!
They cried in unison, and Mark was on his knees, encircling them in his arms. And then, I loved him again.
Lottie. The white is easier to describe. The white is power. It's like flying. It's like living the way I've always wanted to live. In the white, I can do anything. Be anything or anyone. It is a glass prism. The rainbows reflecting off the walls and fractured diamonds of color. I am perfect. In the white, I am a poet, an artist, a musician, a scholar. I'm a star in the sky, nestled into the soft atmosphere, watching the world around me. From my perch in the sky, I understand it all. Everything is connected. Everything makes sense. The man in the grocery store struggling to choose between two brands of bread is my soulmate. The woman with the surly grin at the post office, I understand the fear that really plagues her, the frustration that makes her bark at customers. And I smile magnanimously as I dash off my packages, presents for Francie's daughters, expensive china dolls that I have purchased for them, identical black-haired girls that will have likely broken by the time they arrive, their porcelain skin cracking. But if they crack, then they crack, and that is meant to be. Everything happens for a reason. The universe is aligned in harmony, even if you cannot see it. But I can see everything. Francie. When I said goodbye to the girls, they cried and begged to come see their aunt. I gave them each a tight squeeze, and Mark must have sensed how close to falling apart I was, because he grasped them firmly by their hands and led them to the door. While Mark took the girls to school, I packed a small suitcase for California. Staring into my closet, I gazed mindlessly at the rows of muted button-down shirts, heavy wool sweaters, corduroys, jeans, and khakis. Not even on the plane, and I already felt the familiar anxiety and exclusion that California seemed to bring out in me. I selected several pairs of jeans and a few light sweaters and cotton shirts and stuffed them into a suitcase.
"You ready?"
Mark asked. He was sitting at the dining room table with his laptop. I nodded, though I wasn't ready at all. I put on my long winter coat, aware that the heavy down parka would be absurd as soon as I stepped off the plane in California. The temperature outside had dropped nearly 20 degrees overnight, and in just the few hours that Mark's car sat on the driveway, the windshield had crusted up again with frost. As he pulled out onto the quiet street, Mark sprayed the windshield and put on the wipers to clear the ice. But it was too cold for water, and I watched as crystals bloomed like flowers. He sprayed more water, and the same thing happened, an intricate latticework of flakes webbing across the glass, making it impossible to see the road. I rested my head against the seat, watching the frost flowers blossom. It would have been beautiful if it weren't so dangerous. The drive to the airport felt longer than usual. Brookline was less than 30 minutes to Logan, but time dripped by slowly, each drop containing a memory. Lottie as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz in the spring of 7th grade, her curly black hair in pigtails, bowing on stage in her sparkly red shoes. Lottie our freshman year at Berkeley during her first episode, before we realized it was an episode, at her computer at 4 o'clock a.m., a pencil holding back her hair, a cup of black coffee beside her while she tapped frantically at the keyboard, oblivious to my loud sighs of frustration in the twin bed across the room. Lottie in the delivery room in Boston on the morning that Autumn and Anna were born. A look of pride and awe and, yes, envy on her face as she held her nieces for the first time. At the airport, Mark pulled up to the taxi stand and let the car idle. He took the suitcase from the trunk and then pulled me into a tight embrace. I buried my face in the clean smoothness of his wool coat. I closed my eyes. The bustle of the airport terminal around us, the whoosh of cars driving past, and Mark's chin resting firmly on my head. Then a taxi honked, and a traffic guard was hurrying Mark along, and I had only a moment to kiss him goodbye and tell him to take care of the girls, the I love you getting lost in the sounds of departure all around us. Lottie. It wasn't always like this. It wasn't supposed to be like this. Every twin knows there is a sibling who is older, even if only by a few minutes. Once, there was a time when I was the strong one. That was the way it was supposed to be, the way it was for many years. I was the one who took care of Francie. I remember a birthday party at our old house in Palo Alto the year Francie and I turned 8. Mother invited all of the girls in our class, and Francie and I helped string pink crepe streamers from the doorways. They hung like the curling tentacles of squid, and every time we entered or left a room, we'd feel the papery softness against our cheeks. It was the last year that we let Mother dress us identically, and we'd picked out matching white dresses that tied in the back with satin sashes. We wore lace ankle socks and shiny black patent leather shoes, and the only way to distinguish us was that my sash was green and Francie's was purple. The guests were scheduled to arrive at 2, and we sat by the dining room window, watching for the station wagons that would come bearing our classmates. Soon, they began to arrive. Pretty little girls in party dresses, holding brightly colored packages carefully in their arms. Second grade was the year that I made different friends. Until then, Francie and I had been inseparable, a private party of 2. But in second grade, I pulled away from her and toward the other girls in the class. Though she tried to follow me, I found myself freezing her out for the first time in our lives, pushing her away and ignoring her when in the presence of my new friends. With no one else to turn to, Francie befriended Enid Brown, a shy, red-headed girl who was lactose intolerant and whose mother carefully packed her a thermos of soy milk and a lactose-free cheese sandwich in the days before everyone ate soy. As the girls arrived one by one, I went to play with my new friends while Francie and Enid sat in the corner of the living room by all of the packages, talking in hushed whispers. Mother tried to engage us in several games as a group. She was unaware of the drift between us, and while I'd heard her tell our father that it was healthy, I knew she was secretly disturbed by it, too. She brought us out to the yard, and we played pin the tail on the donkey, and then she gathered us on the patio for apple bobbing. Each girl bent over the large silver pot, and some of us arose victorious with bright red and green Macintosh apples clenched precariously between our teeth. When it was Francie's turn, she kept diving headfirst into the pot, but each time she came up with a dripping wet face and no apple. The other girls began to giggle as Francie kept at it, doggedly aiming for the apples but only spilling water all over her pretty new dress. Mother watched helplessly, finally pulling Francie gently aside and handing her a dish towel while ushering another girl forward. The piñata was meant to be the highlight of the party, just before cake and presents. It was in the shape of a giant pink and yellow horse. And as we were falling asleep at night over the past few weeks, Francie and I discussed the type of candy that might be inside. Lollipops? Chocolate bars? Miniature bags of M&Ms? Those soft caramels with the sweet white centers? The possibilities were endless, and we were both dying to take a wooden bat to the horse, waiting for the crack that would shower us all with candy. Francie went first. Mother knotted one of our father's old ties across her eyes and spun her in a circle three times. When she released her, Francie was dizzy and disoriented, the yellow paisley tie still blocking her vision. She swayed on her feet, her back to the piñata, the wooden bat limp in her hands. She took several steps forward, swinging awkwardly at the air. A few girls giggled as Francie wandered several feet farther away from the hanging horse. She swung again, as if she were a farmer with a scythe slicing fields of wheat. I looked helplessly at Mother as the giggles grew louder. "Hang on a minute, Francie," Mother said, stepping forward cautiously so that Francie wouldn't knock her with the bat. She placed her hands on Francie's shoulders again and turned her around so that she faced the piñata, walking her forward a few feet. "Okay, try again," she instructed. Francie tried. She did. But it was as if the bat were too heavy for her slim arms. Each swing that she took was at least a foot below the piñata. The snickering started again, soon erupting into howls of laughter. Only Enid, Mother, and I were silent. Marissa Dawson was a pale, skinny girl with long brown hair, the ends of which she often sucked on, leaving her hair in wet points around her shoulders. In second grade, this was not seen as the disgusting habit it would later become. It marked her as cool and self-assured, like gum-chewing or eye-rolling. Marissa was in my new group of friends, though I didn't particularly like her. Even then, I recognized the streak of meanness that coiled through her personality. Marissa was nearly bent over with laughter, her lank brown hair a skirt of sharp, wet peaks. She covered her mouth with one hand, the other pointing at Francie, who swung uselessly several feet away from the piñata.
"Oh my God, look at her!"
Marissa shrieked to the other girls. "Shut up, Marissa!" I hissed. Mother looked at me in disapproval, but didn't say anything. Marissa continued to howl with laughter.
"What's wrong with her? Is she retarded?"
she asked the group. The giggling of the other girls quieted. They looked at me, their eyes wide, and then they turned away from Marissa, quickly distancing themselves from her. They might not have been friends with Francie, but the others understood that there were some lines that shouldn't be crossed. Francie stopped swinging, lowering the bat to the ground. She was now directly under the piñata. There was no chance that she'd ever be able to reach it. This seemed to dawn on her at the same time she heard Marissa. The bat hit the grass with a soft thud, though Francie didn't remove the tie. I knew that when she did, her eyes would be red and filled with tears. Her birthday party ruined. Eyes darted nervously between Marissa, me, and Mother, waiting to see who would intervene.
"What?"
Marissa asked, her voice growing whiny and nasal.
"She can't even hit the stupid piñata. I'm just saying, maybe she's retarded."
It was that word being used one more time that did it. I might have let it go. If she just shut up, I might have let Mother handle it. But she'd said it yet again, causing Francie's shoulders to hunch over even more, her head hanging on her neck like a broken doll's. Before I even realized it, I lunged at Marissa. I felt the weight of her body against me as I knocked her to the ground. Marissa was small for her age and young, too. She wouldn't turn 8 till the following spring. It was easy to hurt her. I scratched at her face and caught the bony curve of her shoulder in my fist.
Don't you call my sister that ever again! Do you hear me? Don't you ever call my sister that!
I screeched at her and tore tiny slivers of skin from Marissa's tender flesh. She didn't even try to fight back, only squealed and wailed like an injured kitten. I couldn't have been on her for more than a few seconds, though it felt like minutes. Pretty soon Mother was behind me, shouting my name as she dragged me roughly off Marissa. Mother's strong, thin fingers dug into my arms, momentarily bringing me back from my feral daze. I allowed myself to be pulled away, though I was still yelling and kicking. Marissa lay on the ground, curled into the fetal position, her body convulsing in sobs. My new white dress was soiled with grass stains and a few dots of blood, but I didn't care. I looked at Francie then. She had removed the paisley tie, and it hung around her shoulders. Her eyes were wide and frightened, though I was glad she wasn't crying. Her small mouth was pursed, and she looked at me like I was a stranger. Some wild animal that had been allowed into her birthday party. But then I watched as her mouth softened, her face relaxing. I smiled at her across the patio, a tiny secret smile I hoped Mother didn't see. "For you," it said. "I would do anything for you." The rest of the party went by in a blur. Daddy came down from his office to tend to Marissa's cuts. They weren't actually that bad, but she was covered in tiny antiseptic and several band-aids. She spent the rest of the party watching television in the den with my father, waiting for her mother to arrive. I would receive a severe lecture later that night, but I think my mother was secretly proud of me, and I was allowed to attend the rest of the party. I no longer remember the presents or the cake, but I do remember that no one knocked the piñata open. It never rained candy down on us in a sweet autumnal storm. Instead, Mother sliced it open with a kitchen knife, a clean split right down its middle. When we peered into the cardboard belly, we were disappointed to find only an assortment of hard candies, jawbreakers, and plastic toys. Not a single piece of chocolate in the whole horse. Francie. When the plane landed at Oakland International Airport, I made my way down to baggage claim. Standing at the carousel, I scanned the crowd. Just as I spotted my black suitcase with the pink ribbon, I realized I was looking for Lottie. The recognition caught me off guard, enough that I missed my suitcase the first time around and had to wait for it to make another long rotation on the conveyor belt. I picked up my suitcase and made my way to the taxi stand outside. It was February, but it was close to 70 degrees in Oakland. I tipped back my head and let the sun warm my face. It hadn't been warm in Boston in a long time, and my skin hungrily drank in the heat. A yellow cab pulled forward, and the driver stepped out to take my suitcase. The interior of the cab smelled faintly of cigarettes and cologne, and I leaned my head against the window and watched the gold cross medallion that hung over the mirror. It swung gently on its chain in a hypnotic rhythm, and I nearly drifted to sleep as I thought about what I needed to do. I would go to Lottie's to pick up the baby, and then we would go to the hospital. I had called Lottie again while waiting at the airport that morning, and though she hadn't answered, she'd sent me a quick text. "I'm okay. Banged up and on pain meds, but I'll live. Take care of Mia, and I'll see you soon." My relief that she was okay was quickly replaced by a swell of resentment. No matter how far I went, she'd always expect me to pick up the pieces for her. I'd been to Highland Hospital once before while in college. Freshman year had started off all right, but following winter break, which we had spent with our father, Lottie plunged into her first major depressive episode. She stayed in bed all day, skipping classes and ignoring the friends she'd made during the first semester. I became more isolated as well, going to Lottie's classes on top of my own to help keep her up to date with what she was missing. It was strange that it took me a full month to realize something was seriously wrong with Lottie. "I'm just tired," was all she said when I tried to get her out of bed. "I have a headache," or "I can't deal with class right now." The excuses were vague and insubstantial, but I chose to believe them. Until one afternoon, when the resident advisor for our dorm came knocking on the door, asking to see Lottie. Shira was a senior, and she'd seen enough in her 3 years as an RA to know when something was wrong. After being told 4 afternoons in a row that Lottie was resting or had a headache, Shira barged into our room, took one look at Lottie, buried in bed, and called health services. The doctor Lottie was referred to diagnosed her with bipolar type 1 and sent her home with a bottle of pills. "How can they diagnose you so quickly? This is the first time you've been depressed," I argued.
"It's not, Francie. Remember last year?" Lottie reminded me.
I thought back to the previous winter when we were still in high school. Lottie had gone through several weeks where I felt her disconnect from me. Her movements were slower, requiring great effort, and she barely talked to me. Returning home from school to spend the rest of the afternoon in the foggy air of her bedroom, she ate little more than sleeves of Ritz crackers and vanilla yogurts, the area around her bed littered with empty containers and wrappers. It happened right before Christmas, and then again in March, around the 1 year anniversary of Mother's death. It didn't seem fair to call it depression. Our mother had died. Wasn't Lottie allowed to be sad, even if the severity of her mourning was belated? Our mother's absence was a tender bruise that ached every day, and just because I got out of bed every morning didn't mean it wasn't painful. Both times, Lottie eventually stripped the sheets and climbed into the tub with no intervention from anyone. She emerged from the bathroom pale and thin, but she was herself again.
"It makes sense," Lottie said softly,
and I thought about how, last year, she had returned to me slowly, her mood growing higher and brighter as she threw herself back into all of the things she loved, school and drama club and the flutter of friends that always surrounded her. That was just Lottie. It never occurred to me that something might be wrong. When she first started taking the medication, I waited anxiously for it to take hold of my sister's fractured mind. After several weeks, I started to see Lottie through the gray haze of her depression, and I was able to let go of the breath I'd been holding for so long. But Lottie hated the drugs. She said they dulled her senses and made it so she couldn't feel anything. It was like watching spring awaken, but not being able to see color. The soft buds on the trees and flowers pushing through the ground all a hueless gray. That was how she described the medication to me. And it made her physically sick, too. She was dizzy and nauseated, and she sometimes threw up. The depression had made Lottie lose weight, but now she was gaining it, her hips growing pillowy and soft, a slight roll hanging over the top of her waistband. The drugs affected her eyesight, and Lottie could no longer read for long periods of time, so I read aloud to her from her textbooks and class assignments. I didn't mind. Lottie was safe for the first time since the cycle started.
The medicine might not be perfect, but it kept Lottie straight and even, and her moods more regular. I hadn't realized just how much Lottie hated the drugs until the night it became clear she'd stopped taking them. She'd been on them for several months at that point. In recent weeks, though, I'd noticed that her mood seemed a little lower. But the medicine didn't prevent Lottie from having some highs and lows. It merely kept them in check. So it didn't occur to me that she might have gone off her meds. At least, not this time. Later, when it would happen again and again, I knew what to look for, and I would immediately go to the medicine cabinet and search for the amber bottle of pills, checking the date of the last prescription and how many of the little blue tablets were in the bottle. I would even check the wastebasket underneath the layers of used tissue. But I didn't yet know the signs or realize how sick Lottie had become until I opened the door to our dorm room that evening. It had been raining all day, a bleak and tearing rain, and as I fumbled with the lock, my fingers were slick with water. My coat was soaked from the walk across campus, and I was eager to get inside to make sure that none of my books or notebooks was ruined. As I opened the door, I knew something was wrong. The window beside Lottie's bed was open, the screen removed. Wind and rain blew fiercely into the room. Papers were scattered across both desks and the floor, and there was a puddle of rainwater by the window. Lottie's t-shirts and jeans lay piled on the floor, soaked through. Several candles burned on the dresser, fat glass jars with pictures of Our Lady of Guadalupe that you could buy at many shops in town. The Blessed Woman on the glass, her head bent in prayer and palms pressed together, cast an eerie glow throughout the room. Lottie was in bed, a motionless heap beneath the blankets. Tiny whimpers came from under the sheets, and I approached her slowly, terrified of what I might find. Reaching out a hand, I pushed the lump that was my sister. I could feel her shape through the thick webbing of cotton and fleece. "Lottie, what's wrong?" I asked. Lottie didn't answer, but her whimpering continued. I couldn't see any part of her, not her fingers or her feet or even her hair. With a tentative hand, I reached out and peeled back the blanket, revealing my sister. It took a moment to see the cuts. At first, all I saw was Lottie's naked body curled into a tight little ball. It was the same body that I had, the same slight shoulders and tiny breasts, though Lottie's was thicker now, her thighs meatier. Despite the extra 10 pounds, I could still see the knobs of vertebrae in her bowed back, and the bones in her rib cage showed through the thin layer of skin like the legs of a spider. Lottie's eyes were closed tightly, her arms clasped around her body in an empty embrace. There was a dark smear on the white skin of her stomach, another against the sheets, and another against her hip bones. I sat on the side of the bed, reaching out to unlock her arms. When I lifted one, I nearly dropped it in horror. It was flecked with little lines of red. Each dash a tiny straight incision. "Oh my God, Lottie, what have you done?" Lottie didn't answer, but she released her tightly clenched fist. From her palm fell the silver scissors from my nail kit. I snatched them from the bed as if they were a loaded gun or some other obvious weapon. I brought the sharp instrument close to my face, peering at the silver blades. "Why did you do this?" I demanded. Lottie's other arm was clean. She hadn't gotten to it yet. I pressed my palms to my forehead, trying to understand what was happening. And then, abruptly, I knew. "Are you still taking your medication?" Lottie didn't answer the question directly. "I couldn't feel anything," she murmured, and my heart dropped a few inches in my chest, a quiet sigh that would become familiar as the years passed.
I had to make sure I could still feel something.
And could you? I asked.
Sort of. But it didn't even really hurt.
Lottie opened her eyes for a moment and looked incredulously down at her handiwork.
Why didn't it hurt?
She closed her eyes again.
My God, Lottie.
I was close to tears. I turned away from her, suddenly so revolted that the naked, bleeding heap on the bed was half of me. I walked to the doorway and flipped on the overhead light. The room was suddenly bathed in a blinding and incandescent yellow, and we both winced at the ugly brightness. I picked up the phone and dialed 911. The rest of the evening was a blur I only half remember. I dragged Lottie from the bed and struggled to get her into a bathrobe. She stared vacantly into space, unwilling or unable to meet my gaze. I remember the small crowd that assembled in the hallway of the dormitory when the EMTs arrived. The medics were kind, young men, only a few years older than us, and they were careful and respectful, letting Lottie shuffle down the hallway by herself while supporting her by the elbows like a frail old woman. I trailed helplessly behind and sat in the back of the ambulance with Lottie. They didn't use the siren, and I choked on the silence. Perhaps it wasn't really an emergency after all. The only sounds were Lottie's occasional moans and the quiet assurances of an EMT. I didn't try to reassure my sister. I had already begun to hate her a tiny bit. A little black kernel the size of an apple seed that would slowly grow over the years. I wondered if maybe I'd been too rash by calling 911. Maybe I should have taken care of it myself. Cleaned and bandaged Lottie's arm and gone to the pharmacy to refill the prescription. If I had taken charge, then the whole floor wouldn't have seen Lottie in her bathrobe and slippers being escorted to the elevator like a crazy person. A crazy person. If I had taken care of it myself, then maybe it wouldn't be true. Lottie. Mia came to me in the white heat of mania. A blessing and a curse. My redemption, my demise. Like everything that happened to me during those flashes, it seemed a brilliant idea at the time. The idea started as tangentially as anything else that happened during the white. I was walking down College Avenue on an October day so beautiful that it was excruciating. Excruciatingly beautiful, excruciatingly beautiful, excruciatingly beautiful. The phrase looped through my mind like a Telecaster's news prompt as I made my way past the panhandlers, students, and professors. I was on a mission. In a matter of minutes, I'd become obsessed with finding a bramble, the sweet jam-filled pastry that Mother used to buy on special occasions. She bought them at an Irish bakery in Palo Alto, but I was determined to find one in Berkeley, and I rushed into every coffee shop, bakery, and deli on the street, breathless, asking for brambles. Most of the workers shook their heads in confusion, either at my request or my frantic appearance. I began to formulate the plan in my head now, how I could drive to the bakery in Palo Alto and go past our old house. Not the condo our father bought after Mother died, but the house we lived in till high school. I would park my car outside, eat my bramble, and sip a cup of sweet coffee and wonder who lived there now. After I finished eating, I'd knock on the door and the new owners would let me in, walk me through the bedroom that Francie and I once shared and the kitchen where our father made homemade pizzas every Sunday night, rolling the dough out on the long wooden table. Miraculously, each of the rooms would look exactly the same, untouched by time or strangers. A little girl. My attention was diverted within a second, and then everything changed. As I barged out of the last bakery in town, I nearly ran into a woman and her daughter. The little girl, though she was dark-skinned and dark-haired, reminded me of Autumn and Anna, as little girls always do. She was with her mother, a beautiful, black-haired woman in a fuchsia sari, her wrists and neck decorated with gold jewelry. I imagined they were from India, a place where I'd never been but had always wanted to visit. India seemed like a place full of enormous color, scents, and unfathomable poverty. And my addled brain quickly jumped from brambles to home to little girls in India. The child held her mother's hand, and though I was barreling out of the tiny bakery with an aggressive force, the girl beamed at me sweetly.
"Hello,"
she said, looking up with a beatific smile. The mother nodded and tightened her rein on the girl's hand. "Hello," I breathed back, transfixed by her deep brown eyes and liquid voice. A second later, they were inside the bakery and I was outside, standing on the sidewalk once again, people rushing past, the brambles forgotten and a new idea planted in my head. A child. My own child. Francie. The cab dropped me off at Lottie's apartment. Like my own street back in Brookline, Lottie's was lined with trees. However, this street was narrow, the houses spaced only a few yards from each other so that it was possible to peer into someone else's kitchen while you were making dinner. Lottie's apartment was in an old yellow Victorian that had been converted into a two-family home. I lived here with Lottie after college, and she'd lived here since, paying practically nothing in rent. I fumbled with my keychain and found the house key I'd had since I left California. When I opened the door, I expected to be greeted by Sally and the baby, but the apartment was quiet. I rolled the suitcase over the threshold and closed the front door. The smell hit me immediately. The acrid odor of garbage was ripe in the air, mixed with the faint scent of the Egyptian musk oil that Lottie had worn since she was a teenager. I slowly made my way down the hall toward the kitchen, where the smell was strongest. Fruit flies circled lazily around a bowl of brown bananas, shriveled apples, and avocados. A mango lay open on a plate, its dull orange flesh dotted with flies. A compost bucket had been left open and several larger black flies buzzed around eggshells and coffee grounds. The anxiety in my chest tightened from the hovering insects and the realization that I would have to clean up the mess, but also out of fear of what I might find elsewhere. The living room was not as bad, though candle wax had melted on nearly every surface. The dried splotches were glued to the coffee table and mantel, the purple and red stains like Rorschach ink blots. Several days' worth of newspapers lay in an uneven heap by the couch, along with a stack of student papers. Lottie's messy red scrawl bleeding over the pages. Unwashed mugs were all over the room, a sticky circle of coffee in the bottom of each one. I continued the disquieting tour, entering the bathroom slowly. The last time I was in this room, an EMT had been sitting with Anna. There had been blood and water on the floor, the scene of an accident. I hadn't been here since that awful night, since I packed my daughters up with me and flew home to Boston. Today, all I found in the bathroom was a yellowed toilet bowl and a garbage pail overflowing with tissues. There were two more rooms left, Lottie's bedroom and the spare room. I stood on the threshold of Lottie's. From the doorway, I saw the unmade bed, the sheets and quilt twisted in a rumpled pile. There were more unwashed dishes and stacks of books. Lottie's open closet door revealed piles of dirty clothes on the floor. I stepped back into the hall. Last April, I'd slept in the guest room with Anna and Autumn, the room that had once been my bedroom. It was white and had a futon that pulled out into a double bed, which I slept on with the girls cocooned around me. The room overlooked the garden Lottie shared with the neighboring apartment, and sun streamed through rice paper Venetian blinds. The room was peaceful and serene, the kind of room perfect for reading or writing or painting. It would be Mia's room now, and I was fearful of what I might find. I pushed the door open and peered inside. The white futon had gone, and a crib stood in its place, a black and white mobile hanging above it. The paper blinds had been replaced with heavy purple curtains that blocked out the light. There was a lavender shag rug on the polished hardwood floors. Lottie's desk was gone. There sat a changing table, stocked with plastic baskets filled with diapers and wipes, powders and lotions. The room smelled like baby oil. Everything was neat, everything in its place. For some reason, this was what brought me to tears. It was worse to see how hard Lottie had tried to keep it together. She'd worked to keep her illness from affecting her baby. Tears slid silently down my face. Hanging on one of the walls was a collection of paintings. Stepping closer to examine the artwork, I was startled to recognize them as paintings I'd done in college. I hadn't seen them since the university's gallery opening more than 15 years earlier, and it was jarring to see them arranged so carefully in Mia's room. The pieces were from a series I'd done of my mother from photographs I found in old albums. Mother had been dead for almost 4 years when I did the paintings. In one, she wore a form-fitting red suit in brushed silk and sat perched on the edge of a wooden chair, primly holding a cigarette. She stared off somewhere just to the left of the viewer, a small, private smile poised on her lips. In another picture, she was on a bench in the evening hours of the day, the sun throwing shadows across her bare legs. She leaned back on her elbows, a striped blanket beneath her, wearing just a sheer white blouse and yellow bathing suit. She was laughing, her nose scrunched up, dark hair blowing around her face. I couldn't remember ever seeing her look so relaxed. In my favorite picture, Mother held me and Lottie as newborns while she nursed. She sat on a couch, several pillows propped in her lap, and we were spread upon them, our dark heads nearly touching. I was amazed by the ease with which she nursed two infants at once, knowing firsthand how difficult it was. There were the telltale new mother circles under her eyes, and her pale skin was drawn, but she looked down tenderly at us in her lap. There were others. Mother in a snowstorm with my grandmother, a woman I'd never met. Mother beside a packed car, waving goodbye. I'd used a tiny paintbrush to capture each scene, and I did the whole series on canvases the size of the photographs. Small, meticulous 4x6s or 5x7s, the details so fine that the viewer had to look closely at the paintings. I had called the series, Mother, Can You Hear Me? And I invited Lottie and our father to the opening of the group show, though I hadn't told them anything about my work. The night was a disaster. I still felt the cringe of shame and sadness, remembering it now. When my father and Lottie arrived at the show, the gallery was already crowded with students, parents, and professors. I was on the other side of the room, away from my work, talking with another artist. Waving to them, I watched as they made their way to the wall that featured my paintings. I excused myself from the conversation, but I didn't go to them right away. Instead, I observed their reaction to the show. My father took in each painting, peering closer to examine the details. At one point, bringing his hand up to the canvas and reaching out to touch his wife's face with a thumb. I watched as he mumbled something to Lottie, his head bent low, and then he made his way to the exit. I hurried over to where Lottie stood by the paintings. "Where's Dad going?" I asked.
"Oh, Francie,"
Lottie said as her eyes filled with tears.
"What?
What's wrong? Where did he go?"
"Francie, these are beautiful. They're lovely. He was overwhelmed."
Lottie shook her head, the tears spilling onto her cheeks.
"He left. He went home."
"What?" I couldn't believe it. "He went home?"
"He couldn't handle it, Francie. It was too much for him. You should have warned him."
Lottie turned back to the paintings, leaning in to examine the one of our mother in the red silk suit.
"She looked so happy in these. But she wasn't. She wasn't happy."
Lottie's blue eyes were bright.
"That's not true," I argued. "Where did you come up with these?"
Lottie asked, without agreeing or disagreeing.
"They're from photographs." "Where did you get them?" "I've never seen them."
"In some albums in Dad's closet?"
"In his closet?"
I nodded, suddenly feeling guilty, though I wasn't yet sure why.
"Did you ever think about why they were in his closet?"
There was a note of accusation in Lottie's voice. "Did you ever think about why we've never seen them before?" I didn't answer her, instead focusing on the painting of us as babies in Mother's lap.
"He doesn't want to see them. It's too hard for him to remember her," she said gently.
I felt a surge of anger then, at both my sister and father, and inexplicably, Mother, too. "Just because he doesn't want to remember her doesn't mean that I don't. He doesn't get to decide that for me, and neither do you." I went to get a glass of wine, the first of many that evening, and my face burned with guilt and anger. By the time I turned again to look for her, Lottie was gone too. I was surprised when I received several offers on the series. I never imagined anyone would want to buy them. My professor told me how rare it was for a young art student to make a profit and had encouraged me to make the sale, but I couldn't imagine it. It would have been like selling my mother's photo albums. Yet I couldn't bear to have the paintings hanging up either, where Lottie or our father would see them. So I packed them in a box that I stuck in the closet of my bedroom on the top of all the old albums that I hadn't returned to our father. When I moved to Boston, I left them in the bedroom closet of this apartment. And Lottie had found them, either recently or more likely years earlier, and had painstakingly hung them in Mia's bedroom, an homage to the grandmother she would never know. And perhaps also to me, the aunt that Mia had never met.
Lottie. When you have been tricking people your whole life, it's amazing how easy it is to trick yourself. So few knew the truth. Even our father knew only bits and pieces before he got sick. Francie and Whit were the only ones who knew everything. And Francie was on the other side of the country, tired of cleaning up after me. And Whit, well, Whit could not stay to see my implosion. He knew me too well. Besides Francie, I think he is the only one who has ever really seen me in all my messy shades of color. He tried so hard to convince me that it was not a good idea. He knew what would happen. He knew, and maybe I knew too, but I didn't want to listen. We tried to convince each other, sitting in a coffee shop on Shattuck,
him sipping black tea as I blew the steam from my coffee. His long legs stuck out at odd angles from underneath the little wooden table. At nearly 6'4", he had trouble fitting into small spaces. The rubber soles of his work boots were caked with thick black soil, and his heavy wool socks stopped at his calves. His legs were strong and bristled with soft blonde hair, his face sunburned from hours spent on his knees in the dirt, making other people's gardens beautiful. Once upon a time, he was a lawyer, but he'd given it up years earlier to plant trees and tend flowers and help things grow. It was hard for me to imagine him as a lawyer in a suit and tie every day. "But why not, Whit?" I asked, for what must have been the 100th time that month.
"Because I don't want children, Charlotte. You know that. You've known that all along. I've always been honest with you about it."
It was true. When we met, Whit told me he never wanted children. For all his love of living things, he had a thick streak of cynicism. He couldn't reconcile bringing life into a world filled with such uncertainty and such pain, suffering, and evil. When he told me he didn't want children, I was 26, electrified by his love. I could have cared less about having babies. But 26 is very different from 36. I still secretly hoped he would decide he wanted a baby with me, and this could be an adventure we embarked upon together.
"Charlotte," he said in the serious tone I knew meant business, "I'm not going to change my mind."
And for the first time, I believed him and understood that nothing I said or did could change anything. "I'm going to do it anyway. I'll go to a sperm bank." The words spilled from some secret place. I hadn't even realized I was going to say them, but as soon as I did, I knew it was true. Whit didn't say anything for a moment, and I wondered if he'd already anticipated this.
"It's not a good idea," he said finally.
I blew on my coffee, barely looking up to register what he'd just said. "Why not?" I asked, trying too hard to make my voice sound casual and light.
"You know why not."
"So you're a liar. It's not that you don't want children. It's that you don't want children with me. You don't think I'd be a good mother." The hurt in my voice took us both by surprise.
"I do not doubt your capacity to love."
His words were careful.
"I think you have a lot to offer a child. But I also know you have the potential to be an unstable mother. I think you know that, but don't want to admit it."
"I'm taking my meds, Whit," I told him, the irritation creeping into my voice. I had been, as soon as I began to think seriously about having a baby.
"Right now," he answered.
"Yes, right now and next week and the week after that."
"And what about the week after that?"
His large hands clasped the small paper cup. Each fingernail was rimmed with a sickle of dirt. "Then, too." He shook his head.
"You'll go off them again, Charlotte. You always do. No matter how bad the next time is, you'll go off them again."
"Don't pretend you know everything. You can't see the future," I snapped.
"You also know that bipolar disorder is hereditary," he said.
"There's a higher chance, but it's not a guarantee."
"Charlotte, I'm sorry. But I don't think it's a good idea. And I can't stand by and watch you do it."
He shifted his legs under the table so that they were fully extended. "What are you saying?" I asked.
"I don't know yet."
He sipped his tea and looked away from me and out the window. We talked about other things after that, plants and books and dinner. I'm not sure if we knew it was the beginning of the end. It seems now that it had been too ordinary for me to recognize amidst the bustle of the coffee shop on a typical Thursday. Who could see the end when the late afternoon sun was creeping through the window, and the man I loved was telling me about the orchids he had ordered that morning? I could picture them, a pink so pale they were almost white, stained a deep crimson at the center. Such delicate plants that required such specific and patient care. But if you gave them what they needed, they were stronger than you could imagine. They would bloom for years. Francie. I was still examining the pictures in the baby's room when the front door opened.
Hello? Francine?
Coming. I hurried into the entryway. Standing in the open doorway was a woman in her early 20s with a sleeping baby in her arms, its head of curly brown hair visible from the end of the hallway.
"Hi, I'm Sally," she said.
I stopped in front of her and stared down at the sleeping form in her arms.
"And this is Mia."
Her cheeks were round and pink, and she sucked contentedly on a pacifier, the little piece of plastic bobbing rhythmically in her mouth. I reached out my arms, and Sally gently handed her to me. She was a warm bundle against my chest, and she sighed in her sleep. When I looked up, Sally was taking in the slight differences between Lottie and me, the small space between my front teeth, the missing beauty mark on my left cheekbone, the lighter shade of my eye color.
"I was going to spend last night here with Mia, but..."
Sally gestured to the disarray around us.
"Charlotte's not usually this messy. It's been a really busy semester for her."
I nodded, but didn't say anything.
"Have you heard how she's doing? Have you been to see her?"
Sally asked. "I just got in a minute ago. I called the hospital last night, and she was going into surgery. She texted to say she was okay, but I don't know anything more."
"I'm so sorry," Sally said. "How awful this must be for you. If there's anything I can do, please let me know. Mia's in daycare a few days a week, but I watch her two evenings while Charlotte is teaching."
Lottie was an English professor at Berkeley, and her schedule changed each semester. Sally and I stood awkwardly in the hallway. All I wanted to do was breathe in the warm baby smell of Mia's neck, press my head into the warm crook of her shoulder, and pretend that this was a happy occasion, this first introduction to my infant niece.
"Oh,"
Sally said suddenly, taking a bag off her shoulder.
"Here's the diaper bag. There's a fresh bottle in the bag for when she wakes up."
"Okay, thank you." I brushed a thumb along Mia's round cheek. "Sally, who is Mia's father?" I asked without lifting my eyes.
"Charlotte went through a sperm donor. I don't really know much more than that. She was always private about it."
I nodded. When Lottie didn't want to talk about something, it was like a steel fortress went up around her.
"Can I help you clean up here at all?"
Sally gestured with her chin toward the kitchen. "No, that's okay. We'll be all right."
"Okay."
She stood uneasily for another moment.
"Well, if there's anything I can do, please let me know. If you need me to watch Mia while you go to the hospital or anything, just knock. I'm right next door."
I thanked her, and she slipped outside, leaving me and Mia alone. I brought Mia into the nursery and settled into the rocking chair. The baby slept soundly, the drunken milk-induced sleep of infants. Her mouth was a heart, her dark hair a curly cap, a miniature pink and cream version of Lottie. I remembered the day I became a mother. Unlike me and Lottie, my girls held on until they were nearly at full term. I was just 2 weeks away from my due date when my water broke. I was in the kitchen, washing the dinner dishes, and it took a moment to realize that the slick liquid coursing down my legs was not soapy dishwater. A strange calm settled over me, and I waited a few minutes to call for Mark. I took my time finishing the dishes, wiping down the counters, folding the damp towels neatly over the drying rack. I held my hands